Genesis. It's the one book in the Bible that I can find very easily. And we're reading Genesis 18, verses 1 through to 15. And the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, as he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing in front of him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, O Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought, and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree, while I bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on, since you have come to your servant. So they said, Do as you have said. And Abraham went quickly into the tent to Sarah and said, Quick! Three seahs of fine flour, knead it and make cakes. And Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf tender and good and gave it to a young man who prepared it quickly. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree while they ate. They said to him, Where is Sarah, your wife? And he said, She is in the tent. The Lord said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. The way of women had ceased to be with Sarah. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, After I am worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure? The Lord said to Abraham, Why did Sarah laugh and say, Shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. But Sarah denied it, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. He said, No, but you did laugh. Let God add to the reading of his word this morning.
As a teenager in the 1980s, I was an avid fan of Jim Unger's Herman cartoons, and I really enjoyed looking forward to the comic section in the newspapers on the weekend where I could read Herman. And even in the 80s, as a teenager, I began to collect the treasuries of Herman, and I've got, I think, the first seven of the eight of them. And one of Jim Unger's cartoons of Herman that you see on the screen is a great introduction or a way into our text this morning. You see there a man and a woman, I'm assuming that they're husband and wife, and she's in a bed, and I'm assuming it's a hospital room, and she, the wife, is holding a newborn baby, and she's speaking to her husband. And the caption that goes under that picture that Jim Unger has drawn is this, and as the wife speaks to the husband, What do you mean you didn't know? I told you weeks ago. So the husband is just completely clueless as to that his wife was pregnant and that he was going to be a father. And I wonder, did Abraham tell Sarah that God said, Sarah is going to be the mother of the promised son? You see, in the chapter earlier, chapter 17, verse 15 and 19, God specifically told Abraham Abraham, Sarah, your wife, she is going to bear the promised son. And she's going to have a child within about a year. Now, did Abraham pass that good news on or not? It's possible that he did not. Because when you look at verses 11 and 12, when Sarah laughs in disbelief, just like Abraham laughs in disbelief in chapter 17, hearing it for the first time, God, in chapter 8, verse 13, when Sarah laughs, he doesn't ask Sarah why she laughs. He asks Abraham in verse 13, Abraham, give me an account. Why is your wife laughing? Perhaps she laughs because this is the first time she's heard it. And just like the first time Abraham heard that in chapter 17, he laughed. Perhaps given the hostility between Sarah and Hagar and Ishmael, Abraham was just keeping that information to himself because he knew if he told Sarah, it's probably going to cause a whole lot more domestic strife. On the other hand, perhaps Abraham had told her, and he's just, you know, looking at the Lord at this moment, shrugging his shoulders and go, you know, I don't have an answer for you. Why she laughs. Whether Abraham told her or did not is anybody's guess. But what is not guesswork, what is for certain, is that this visit by the Lord is for the purpose, as seen in verses 1 through 15, the express purpose of the Lord himself, God himself, giving Sarah the news directly from his own mouth, from an encounter with him, that she shall be the mother of the promised son. All these promises that Abraham has heard from God, that he's going to be made into a great nation, and all these things, she's going to be the mother of all those nations. She's going to be the mother of the promised son. Notice that once they are served, the visitors initiate the conversation in verse 9 with a question. Where is Sarah? Abraham says, you know, she's behind me. She's in the tent. She's obvious, she's within hearing distance. And the Lord knows where she is, but they bring up the question. They bring up her name, so she's going to pay attention because they know where she is. They know that they can hear her. Notice from verses 9 through to 15, Sarah is mentioned 9 times in the text. This is why they've come. They want her to hear the promise herself. They want to hear her to hear it from God's own lips. And through that text, verses 9 to 15, twice she is told directly from God and given the confirmation that the promise that she has heard God say or has been said to Abraham is now also said to her. And she is going to be that mother. And she will be the mother of many descendants. And she will have the news also of a specific birth period. Within a year, she shall be holding her own son. Now, before we move on, we should note something about Abraham's hospitality. His running out and bowing and greeting the strangers and inviting them in to have some rest and to have some refreshments and things like this, that's all standard ancient Near Eastern hospitality. That's just the way things were done. However, there's a couple things that are a bit unusual. First of all, the haste, the hurry. You notice the verbs in there. You know, Abraham, he runs out there and then he tells Sarah, you know, hurry quickly, bake the bread. He runs out to the herd, gets a calf, and has it prepared quickly. So he's very, very quick, very moving with great haste. And the second thing that is a little bit unusual is he's extravagant in his food. It was interesting in the text there, he says, you know, come and rest yourself in verse 4 and 5 while I bring a morsel of bread. Well, he tells Sarah to prepare 3 seahs of flour. A seah is equivalent to between 7 to 8 liters of flour. So he's saying, Sarah, bake 3 to 3 seahs. That's over 20 liters of flour for bread. It's far more than they can eat. And then he gets a young calf, a bull. This is premium meat. Think of the beef normally is for special occasions only. And think too, when God in the next book in Exodus and Leviticus, he gives and sets up the Mosaic system of sacrifices. It's the beef, it's the bull, it's the calves that are the most expensive, the most costly sacrifices. So he's giving them the best meat that he has. In that situation, a goat would have been quite sufficient. But he gets a young calf. So this is something that's unique, something different about his hospitality. The great haste and eagerness with which he serves these 3 visitors and with the amount and quality of the food that he gives to them. Now, Sarah is not only infertile, meaning that she has never been able to bear or conceive a child. She also, as stated in verse 11, she's postmenopausal. She cannot have children. She's past the age of bearing children. And so when she hears the statement of the Lord that she is going to this time next year have a son, she laughs. She goes, "That's impossible. That's ridiculous. That's ludicrous. That's humanly impossible. It cannot be done. What a joke. I wish it would be true, but it's still just out of reach. It's impossible." And God gives a rhetorical question in verse 14 as part of a statement to her. He says, "Is anything too hard for the Lord?" And it has the expected answer that no. Nothing is too hard for the Lord. And this raises an issue about the character of God. Just what can God do? How powerful is God? What does it mean when we say God has all power? Can God really do anything? Sometimes there is misunderstanding about God's power and his possession of all power and his execution of it. And it's helpful for us to consider this question for a few moments. Is anything too hard for the Lord? Now, theologians have taken this character trait of God, of having all power, and they've given it a name, omnipotence, made up of the word potent, meaning power, and omni, meaning all. So omnipotence, put it together, all power. That means God is all powerful. And when you look through our Bibles, you read through our Bibles, the pages, every page is screaming to us the power of God and how powerful God is. Just start with Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Stop and think for a moment. Remember your science lessons. How much power is in the universe? How many natural forces? And try to calculate the power of the suns and the stars and calculate the power of the wind and the waves and the power, the cosmic energy. Well, if you're going to create that, you got to be more powerful than all of that combined. And the Bible has many acts of God that are recorded for us and many statements. I'll just, briefly, give you a few of these statements about God and his power. 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 5 to 6. "And Jehoshaphat stood in the assembly of Judah and Jerusalem in the house of the Lord before the new court and said, 'O Lord, God of our fathers, are you not God in heaven? You rule over all the kingdoms of the nations. In your hand are power and might, so that none is able to withstand you.'" Daniel chapter 4, verse 34 to 35. "At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him who lives forever." Well, if you live forever, you've got to have all power. "For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. And he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? So again, a very clear statement of God's utter unlimited power. And then you have Jesus in Matthew chapter 19, verses 25 to 26. Jesus has just made the shocking statement that it is easier for a rich man, or sorry, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to get into heaven. And it says in Matthew 19, verse 25 to 26, when the disciples heard this, they were greatly astonished, saying, who then can be saved? But Jesus looked at them and said, with man this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. So what does it mean that God has all power, or he's all powerful, or he's omnipotent? What does that mean? Well, what it does not mean is that God can do absolutely everything we could conceive of or think of, or that could be imagined. So if you were to take a look at Hebrews 6:18, it says this, so that by two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie. You can look at 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 13. It says, if we are unfaithful, God remains faithful, for he cannot disown him or deny himself. Or then there's James 1:13. It says, God is not able to be tempted, nor does he tempt anyone. So when we look at the broader teaching of the whole Bible about God and his power and the use of his power, we see that God cannot deny or act or behave contrary to his very nature or his character. So God is truth, therefore he cannot lie. He cannot use all the power that he possesses to lie. God, because he is constant in his character and is trustworthy in his character, will always be faithful. He will always fulfill his promise. He will always do what he says. Because that's the nature of his character. Because God is good, pure good and righteousness, he will never do anything evil. He will never tempt people to do evil. He's not the source of evil. He is instead pure and utter goodness. So there are things God cannot do. He cannot go and use his great power to do something other than what he really is in his character. He cannot deny it. He cannot act contrary to his character with his power. And that is a really great thing. Think about it. If God's character determines the use of his power, he will only use his power in an all-wise and good and wonderful manner, and just and righteous way. Imagine if God's character was evil. Imagine if God was cruel by nature, and he had all this power, and then how would he use it? Oh, that'd be our worst nightmare, that God would be evil and have all power. That would be terrifying. So when we say that God is all-powerful, we have to remember that that does not mean he can do absolutely anything we can imagine. No, it means he can do anything he pleases that is consistent with his character. And that brings us to the second thought then of what it means that God has all power. It means he possesses in himself all the power necessary to freely accomplish whatever he wills in accordance with his character, and there's nothing external to God that can stop him from doing what he pleases. So there's nothing, as long as it does not deny his character, then there is no power outside of God, there is no energy outside of God, there's no person or people or nation or devil and nothing outside of God that can stop him from doing what pleases him. Nothing. That's what it means he is all-powerful. He can do all that he wishes to do in accordance with his righteousness and his goodness and his justice, and no one can stop him. So let's go back to Sarah. Now in verses 13 and 14 of Genesis 18, his reply, you know, is there anything too hard for the Lord? It's a gentle rebuke to her, but at the same time, that question, he's teaching her, he's helping her understand and realize who he is. He's revealing himself to her. He's saying, look, Sarah, I am the God who is not limited. I am all-powerful. Nothing is too hard for me. So when I say, and I promise you, Sarah, that next year you're going to have a son in your arms, it's going to happen. Because there's nothing external to me that can stop me, and that includes, Sarah, the obstacle of your entire life having been infertile, and you're now being presently postmenopausal, unable to bear children, past that age. That cannot stop me. It is not too hard for me. I am omnipotent. I am all-powerful. And so in time, Sarah's laughter at the impossible is going to be changed into the laughter of joy. For what was impossible with humans was made possible by the Lord, by his actions. And it's interesting, as I think most of you should know, that as they call Isaac's name in the future when he's born and they call him as a child, they're going to be reminded both of their own disbelief and their laughter at God's promise of unbelief, but then also they'll be reminded of the laughter of joy, because as God said in Genesis chapter 17, verse 19, God told Abraham, you're going to name the child Isaac, and Isaac means what? He laughs. He laughs. God's being all-powerful, or his omnipotence, it's not a promise. It's a character trait of God. God says nothing's too hard for him. That's a great truth that we need to penetrate into our souls and our minds, and to encourage and enable our faith to grow. It's the fact that God is all-powerful is a truth that we need to live by according to what God has revealed, the unseen but real reality that is around us and the future that is not yet here but is coming. We need to grow in our faith and our understanding of his being all-powerful. But John Walton carefully points out that even though God is able to do many things, and that what is impossible for us is all possible for God, even so, just because that is who he is and what his character is like, that does not mean he is promising to always change our difficult circumstances or simply solve with a snap of the fingers our impossible situations and our difficult troubles. Walton writes, and I quote, "We must be cautious that as we accept by faith that nothing is too hard for God, we do not begin to dictate to him which hard thing he must do. Rather, the rhetorical question of 1814 does not present us with a promise to claim, but an attribute of God to embrace, a faith to aspire to, and a hope to sustain us." End of quote. So in other words, he's giving us a healthy warning, and he's saying, look, don't fall into the mistake of approaching God because he has all powerful as some type of cosmic Mr. Fix-It, whom you are simply going to demand and require to use all his great power to fix the things and the troubles and that you have in your life the way you want. Sometimes our all-good and all-powerful God, he has his own perfect purposes for which he will use his power in ways in our life and in our situations that we would never have dreamed or imagined. sometimes he chooses, quote unquote, the harder thing to do. Rather than just fix our situation, he chooses to train us through our situation. He trains us to accept our limits. He trains us to depend on him. He trains us to grow through our pain. And he tests us through our troubles and trials rather than just simply removing them. So when he does, we will grow in knowing who God is, and we are able to bow in obedience and service and submission before him as he works out his good and perfect will through how he uses his power in whatever way he has determined that pleases him in our situations. I'd like to give you an example of this. Most of you who are probably 40 and older will know this lady, Joni Erickson Tada. And you will know her story that as a teenager in a diving accident in 1967, she broke her neck and she became a quadriplegic as a result of that, paralyzed from the shoulders down. And in her own testimony, Joni says this of her early days. I remember my friend Steve, a young teenager who had a caring, compassionate heart, a love for God, and a halfway decent working knowledge of the Bible. At my bedside, I cornered him one day. And I said to Steve, I don't get it. I trusted God before this accident. I wasn't a bad person. This possibly couldn't be a punishment for my sin, and at least that I've done. At least I hope not. I don't get it, Steve. If God is supposed to be all-loving and all-powerful, then how is this, which has happened to me, be a demonstration of his love and power? Because Steve, if he's all-powerful, then surely he should have been powerful enough to stop my accident from happening. If he's all loving, then how in the world can permanent and lifelong paralysis be a part of his loving plan for my life? I just don't get it. And unless I find some answers, I don't see how this all-loving and all-powerful God is worthy of my trust and confidence. Who is in control? Whose will is this anyways? I said to him. End of quote. God had a plan for Joni. And to physically heal her from her paralysis, he could have done that in a microsecond, in a nanosecond. It would have been simple for him to do that. That would have been, quote unquote, from the human perspective, the easy thing to do. But God, being all wise, all knowing, all perfectly good and powerful, he decided to do something harder. He wanted to move Joni past her bitterness and the shock and the denial and the depression and the suicidal desires to actually accept the paralysis as his will for her and then have her submit herself and that to him so that he may use her in her paralysis in that state for the rest of her life to touch tens and hundreds of thousands of people's lives through the rest of her life. Now, Steve went on and wrestled with what I read to you, what Joni challenged him with and asked the questions he had. And Steve said to her, I don't know the answer of how this fits in God being all loving and how your paralysis fits in there and all this type of stuff. He says, I don't know all the answers to that. But Steve went on to talk about the cross and Jesus dying on the cross, and he said, Joni, look at that. He said, at the cross, in Jesus' death, both God is at work and Satan was at work. In the same event, but for different purposes. Satan and the men who decided to crucify Jesus and handed Jesus over, they were working to put an end to Jesus. They were working to destroy Jesus and his work. They were murdering him. That was their evil. But at the same time, God, who is sovereign, having all power, worked and overrode and worked through that evil so that the cross of Jesus and his death was not the end of Jesus and the end of all hope. It was the foundation and the securing of human's salvation. So he said to Joni, he says, you see, God's working and overriding the evil that was at work there. And he brought this out of it. Now you can access the entire story. I would encourage you to listen to the whole exchange between Joni and Steve as she tells of it. And you'll be able to find the web address on the bottom of the first page on the outline, the green outline. So I encourage you to go on and hear it all. But I want you to hear part of Joni's answer, and this is her speaking, telling the story, as she responded to what Steve said to her about God and Satan at work at the cross. So if you'd play that, Bruce, that'd be great.
And it didn't take long for me to understand the parallel between what happened at the cross of Christ and what happened at the crux of my own disability. I began to see that in the accident in which I became paralyzed, heaven and hell were participating in the exact same event, but for different reasons. When I took that reckless dive into shallow water that caused me to be a quadriplegic, no doubt the devil absolutely wrung his hands in delight, thinking to himself, ha ha, I have now shipwrecked this girl's faith, I have dashed her hopes, I have ruined her family, I have destroyed her dreams, and I am going to make a mockery of all of her beliefs in God. That, I'm certain, was the devil's motive. But remember, we have an all-wise, all-powerful, all-loving God who reaches down into what otherwise would be horrible evil and wrenches out of it positive good for us and glory for himself. And I am convinced that God's motive, God's purpose, his plan in the accident in which I became paralyzed, his purpose was to turn a headstrong, stubborn, rebellious kid into a young woman who would reflect something of patience, something of endurance, something of long-suffering, who would get her life values turned from wrong side down to right side up, and who would have a buoyant and lively, optimistic hope of heavenly glories above.
Since 1967, Joni, despite being paralyzed from the neck down, as some of you will know, has become an internationally known mouth artist, the author of more than 25 books translated into 33 languages, contributed to a daily radio broadcast, recorded several albums, and developed a Christian ministry organization in 1979 for disabled people that since in 2006 has become the International Disability Center. What if God had just simply took away her paralysis in those early days? There'd be none of these things, none of these other impossible things that he wanted to do and exercise his great power in these amazing ways. Infertility, such as Sarah had, is not good, not a good thing at all. But it would not stop God from fulfilling his promise. Sarah, you're going to have a son by this time next year. I have all power. It's not too hard for me. Spinal cord injuries, quadriplegia, not good. But that did not stop the will of God from using Joni to develop an international ministry to disabled people. Your circumstances right now that you may be facing, they may not be good. They may be downright horrible, horrific, overbearing. But God is not only all-powerful and sovereign, he is good. He's all-knowing. He's wise. It's a marvelous combination of character that makes him worthy of our trust and our obedience and our worship. Is anything too hard for the Lord? And I want to end the service a little bit different this morning, having reflected upon God being all-powerful. And maybe you have been thinking and drawn to your mind situations that you're facing, whether it's specifically your own or within your wider family or whatever. And you're thinking, this is impossible. I don't know what to do. I don't know how I'm ever going to get through this. I can't make it. And I want to give you the opportunity during the closing or the final song to come forward. And maybe just come up here. And instead of singing, just pray. Come to the Lord who is all powerful. And just submit the situation to Him, the impossible situation, and yourself, submit yourself to Him to say, Lord, you have freedom to use your great power to address me and my situation however you please. I need you. I am weak. I'm broken. I'm desperate. I'm going to drown. I'm going to sink if you don't step in. And you just want to cast yourself before Him. Then I invite you to come. I'm going to go there because I got impossible situations in my life. I would like to turn them over afresh to Him. And you can stay there as long as you want, even after the song is done. Peter's going to give the benediction. I will stay there. And if you want someone to pray with you, I can pray with you. I'm going to ask those on the deacon and deaconess board if you just come up too, and you can approach them, and they'll pray for you, pray with you as you face your impossible situation and allow God to just minister to you and to as you cast yourself on Him. And then also, don't think of this just as an individual exercise. What about corporately as a church? We need to approach God as the all-powerful God and cast ourselves on Him because we have things amongst us that are impossible for us to address, to heal, to correct. We have external things to us as a group of believers that are impossible for us to do unless the Lord meets us and exercises His power through us. We need to collectively cry out to the Lord for His power and His direction. So I ask the team to come forward. I will go and I